This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Groucho Marx once said that the trouble with writing a book about yourself is you can't fool around. Why not? People fool around with themselves all the time. I'm Tristram Shandy, the main character in this story, the leading role.
That's Steve Coogan in the new movie Tristram Shandy, A Cock and Bull Story. It's a movie about making a film adaptation of the virtually unfilmable 18th century comic novel Tristram Shandy. The movie alternates between scenes from Tristram Shandy and scenes on the film set. Coogan plays himself, as well as Tristram Shandy and Shandy's father. The new film is directed by Michael Winterbottom, who also directed Coogan in 24-Hour Party People. Coogan was featured in Jim Jarmusch's movie Coffee and Cigarettes and co-starred in Happy Endings. In England, he's well known for his alter ego Alan Partridge, the self-absorbed and clueless TV talk show host and radio DJ that Coogan played on BBC TV. You can see reruns on BBC America. Tristram Shandy will be opening gradually in theaters around the country starting at the end of the month. Steve Coogan, welcome to Fresh Air. Does it mess with your mind to be playing a version of yourself that isn't quite yourself, knowing that when we viewers watch it, we might think that that is really you?
I don't mind. I kind of like playing with, I like blurring the edges of fact and fiction sometimes. It's more fun. I know some people... The important thing to me was that it was not self-indulgent narcissism, that the parts of the story that feature me playing myself help people understand the essence of the novel within the film. So it was important to me that people didn't think, why the hell are we watching this movie about an actor we've never heard of? And also just there's something interesting about, for those people who do know me or become aware of when they're watching the film that they're watching an actor playing himself, is how much of it is real and how much of it is not. And so it's kind of, there's a double bluff going on. If you play yourself in an unsympathetic way and you're allowing that to happen, that somehow you're kind of rising above that. And
well, you've just put your finger on it, that you play yourself in a somewhat unsympathetic way. I mean, you're not the most sensitive person in the movie. You're very competitive. Even though your girlfriend has come with the baby that you had together to be with you, she's traveled 200 miles, you have an affair with someone else. It is not like the most sympathetic portrait. Of course, the movie's a comedy. But so are you not the kind of actor who'd say, that's not flattering, I don't want to do it?
No, I think the work I've done so far, I've played characters before that are not me, but I've used elements of me in the writing of those characters. And often if you're trying to make comedy, and subtle comedy that's kind of illuminating and interesting, you have to use elements of yourself that aren't sympathetic. But obviously when you're creating a character, you have a different name, and therefore you kind of distance yourself from it, and you're saying this is a creation, it's not me. Whereas I'm playing a little game here. So I actually think that the work that attracts me is portraying characters, you know, and this one happens to share my name, and as I've admitted, there are certain things within my personality that I've drawn upon when I improvise. You kind of give rent, maximize and articulate those parts of your personality that are unsympathetic, and the parts of my personality that I think are kind of well-adjusted and well-rounded, I kind of keep those in check and don't really show much of that, because it's actually dramatically less interesting and doesn't make for good comedy. Most comedy characters are not rational, well-rounded, well-adjusted human beings. So, if you like, I kind of... you have to give free rein to those parts of yourself that are dysfunctional.
I've mostly seen you in comedies or, you know, movies that had comic elements to them, like 24-Hour mm-hmm. Party People, Happy Endings that came out this summer, in which you played Lisa Kudrow's brother, the new film Tristram Shandy, and of course the TV work that you've done as Alan Partridge, the talk show host and radio DJ. Who are some of the comics and actors that inspired you when you were growing up?
Well, there were lots of people in people who inspired me, I think, in England. There were the usual people like Monty Python and Peter Sellers. American comics that influenced me were, I guess, you know, the SNL people, all those people who emerged in the late 70s in America, you know, the Belushis and Aykroyds. And more recently, of course, hugely influenced by Rob Reiner in the film This Is Spinal Tap. That was a big influence for me.
Oh, sure, because you created a whole kind of like fake BBC talk show and a character named Alan Partridge. Can you talk about creating him and why you wanted to create this fake talk show host?
I wanted to create a character who represented all the things I found banal and inane in media commentary, because in the kind of lowbrow areas of the media, people try to condense things and compartmentalize them and turn them into it's a very reductive kind of medium. And also there's a lot of kind of vanity that exists within television. And it just seemed like a very ripe area of comedy that hadn't been explored so much. Larry Sanders came out in England soon after I was doing Alan Partridge, and that was often compared with that character. But it was just an area of comedy. You always, when you explore comedy, you always look for areas that you feel haven't been exploited, and that struck me as one of them. And you can hear it in any kind of daytime, talk show host on any cable channel. And often in sports commentators, the funniest thing I find is when a commentator has to fill in and say stuff to fill the gaps in the airtime rather than actually making serious commentary. So they end up having to just say words that don't mean anything. And I think that's the thing that made me think there was a lot of comedy there.
Well, and it's a lot of fun as an interviewer myself watching you as Alan Partridge interview guests. On one edition of the show, you're interviewing a woman from Playboy magazine. And this is a great example of what happens when you don't read the book before you interview an author. let me play a clip of this. So this is you as Alan Partridge interviewing a woman author from Playboy magazine.
Now, Daniela Forrest, you are Playboy's agony aunt. And you've also just published your autobiography.
Luck Be a Lady.
There it is. That's the book. There we go. It's your autobiography. It's published by Jones. Never heard of them. what comes across very strongly is your understanding of male psychology.
Well, I think I understand men because I adore them.
Yeah. And what, as a woman, do you look for in a man?
Power is attractive. Mm-hmm. Sensitivity. Sense of humour. I like a man who knows who he is.
I'm Alan Partridge, carry on. Now, you also help people with their sexual problems. Let me give you a hypothetical problem. there's a couple. Right? They've been married 15, 16 years, maybe more. And they've never slept, neither of them have ever slept with anyone else.
And he's frustrated?
Yes, deeply. But that's only part of the problem. The real problem is that their sex life is, well, for want of a better word, moribund.
People need to explore their sex lives if they're not working, you know. If it's not working in the bedroom, bring it into the living room or the kitchen.
Yeah, well they tried that, but the dog just wanted it. It was very awkward.
You see, some people, they find it very sexy to be watched.
Not by the dog, I mean.
Once again, here is a man shying away from discussing sex. When I was a man, I used to have the same problem, but as a woman, I find that I am liberated.
Well, I'm very pleased for you. Now, hang on a minute. Who was a man?
When I was a man.
What are you talking about?
Will you have read my book?
Yes. No, I never read the books.
Why did you invite me on your show?
I thought you were sexy. I don't now. You're a bloke. I've got my to knock your block off.
That's Steve Coogan as Alan Partridge, and the series runs on BBC America. It must have really been fun to dress yourself as the character of Alan Partridge. You wear some horrible suits and sweaters in it. Would you describe one of your favorite costumes?
There's a certain way that businessmen who are used to wearing suits all the time try and dress when they have their weekend off or they're wearing casual clothes. And because they're not generally comfortable in casual clothes, they never look completely comfortable in them. And it's just kind of slacks that have a kind of an iron crease right down the middle and loafers that look like they're just straight off the shelf and nothing's worn in or comfortable. It's all kind of crisp and kind of anally retentive in the way it's kind of put on. And there's a vague golfing theme to it as well. He calls it sports casual, but it's buttoned down, crisp, kind of non-faded, super bright middle-aged men's clothes. I think we've all seen them.
Alan Partridge is the kind of person who always has opinions and gives his opinions with great confidence, although they're usually, you know, incredibly foolish. And I thought I'd play another clip, and this is from the radio version. After his talk show on TV fails, he becomes a radio DJ. And here's a clip from the opening episode of the Alan Partridge series as a radio DJ.
That was Big Yellow Taxi by Joni Mitchell, a song in which Joni complains that they paved Paradise to put up a parking lot, a measure which actually would have alleviated traffic congestion on the outskirts of Paradise, something which Joni singularly fails to point out, perhaps because it doesn't quite fit in with her blinkered view of the world. Nevertheless, nice song. It's 4:35 a.m. You're listening to Up with the Partridge.
That's my guest Steve Coogan as Alan Partridge. It must really be fun to play somebody who's so free with their opinions and makes such a fool of themselves when giving it.
It's great because, you know, I'll often, like most people, we may think things now and again which we oughtn't to think, but we don't say them out loud. We might have a thought and chastise ourselves about it and think, well, I thought that about that person, but I shouldn't really think that, and so I don't say it out loud because I know that's inappropriate. And so what Alan does is he doesn't have that normal editing checking process that most human beings have, so he says stuff he shouldn't say. And also is that kind of, there's a famous quote from Alexander Pope which says, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. And Alan has lots of a little knowledge, so he doesn't know a lot about anything. And that makes for good comedy, because you just talk, you speak first and think later.
Now, you've done a lot of impressions over the years. You got started, I think, on Spitting Image, which was a puppet satire of politics in England, and you did voices for that. Were you always good at impressions?
Yeah, I did. You know, I used to do lots of voices, and it was a way into the business. You know, it's very difficult these days to try and get on as an actor. Very difficult. So you have to kind of do a quick trick, something to get someone's attention very quickly to be noticed. And impressions were one of those things. I used to do a lot of people, like you know, actors and politicians. I do Roger Moore and speak like that in a very reserved kind of way. I do Sean Connery, who, of course, has that real deep Scottish brogue. And I do people like Michael Caine, who are altogether slightly different, with a very, very slight Cockney sound to their voice.
My God, that's perfect. That was really perfect.
Well, thank you very much.
Has he heard you do that?
Michael Caine hasn't. Roger Moore has. In fact, I had Alan Partridge actually interviewed Roger Moore for real a couple of years ago for a homeless charity in London.
Oh, gosh.
He agreed to do it. He was a very good sport. He didn't mind Alan being ill-informed and wanting constantly to talk about James Bond, which is something that Roger Moore, I'm sure, has moved on from a long time ago. So he was a great sport about that. And he knew that I'd been one of the people who'd satirized him and poked fun at him on Spitting Image. But there's a very good kind of all the kind of the British may have their faults, but I think being able to laugh at themselves is one that they're quite good at.
It must be odd for you when you're playing a character in real life interviewing a real person. I mean, Roger Moore's part wasn't scripted, right?
Semi-scripted.
Oh,
I mean,
I gave him
some ripostes because I knew Alan was going to say unsympathetic things to him.
Like what?
And I said something like, I said, do you think? I said, as Alan, I said, do you think I'd
I'd make a good spy, Roger.
I think he said something like,
No, to be a spy, you have to be subtle, well-observed, discreet, and intelligent.
And so, of course, you know, that didn't sit very well with Alan. So that was a lot of fun, yeah. And the character was quite popular in England. I did an interview with Elton John on this TV show, and that was great fun because I said to him beforehand, I said, do you mind if I'm quite rude to you as Alan? And he said, do your worst, you know. So I was pretty merciless with him, you know. I sort of talked about the fact that he was gay.
What did you say to him about being gay?
I said something like, you are a gay man. I said, you know, and you're allowed, you know, something about the kind of suit he was wearing. I think he was wearing a pink suit. And I talked about it being, you know, you wouldn't have worn that years ago. But after you, you know, came out, I can't remember what it was. Something about him coming out and, you know, wearing a pink suit and how I wouldn't wear something like that. And because Alan's slightly, I think, sort of very, ever so slightly, he's never very malicious, but there's just, he's ever, ever so slightly homophobic, which makes for good comedy, of course, especially when you're interviewing Elton John.
So how did you come up with the voice for Alan Partridge?
Well, you listen to lots of broadcasters on... I used to do lots of voiceovers, actually, on TV commercials. You know, the kind of, if you want a better deal from Ford, get down to blah, blah, blah today. It's only, you know...
did you really?
$48 a month and all that kind of, like, APR, 22%, blah, blah, blah. You know, I do all that kind of stuff, cramming in those inane, nasty, cheap, disposable radio commercials that we all try and avoid but seem to intrude into our lives every day. So I did a lot of that, and you get familiar with these kind of... Some broadcasters, you get the idea, seem probably love the sound of their own voice a bit too much. Those people who speak with a very deep, warm brown voice on radio shows where they talk in a very sort of subtle way like that, and you get the impression that they like the ups and downs of the timbre of their own voice. That kind of thing. You hear all that stuff. And there is there's certain people who, because they are thinking as they speak, will emphasize any word arbitrarily for no reason whatsoever. So there's no proper syntax to what they're saying. And you just think, why are they speaking like that? And they say, well, obviously, because they're not quite sure what they're saying. So there used to be, there's a certain fashion in Britain at the moment for Scottish and Welsh accents, but very, very subtly applied. So you'll often see an Irish also, which was used to be a real no-no, because, of course, 50 years ago, Irish were second-class citizens in England. But now that you'll hear them, you'll often hear people on adverts with a very slight Irish accent like that, because it's seen as approachable and friendly and not distant, like a lot of British accents. And you'll hear the Scottish for the same reason, because, of course, they were oppressed by the English, so, of course, they can't be all bad. You know? So that's used a lot, because then it has that kind of slight anti-establishment vibe about it, which makes something appear less governmental, I think.
Did you study voice, or did you just, like, pick all this up yourself?
I studied it a little bit. I went to drama school to study, and they teach you how to... Because I'm from the north, and of course, you know, you learn what they call received pronunciation, which has always made me laugh. Which was stemmed from the way you are supposed to be received by royalty.
Is that what it means? You know, I've heard that expression. I've never understood what it meant.
Yeah, no, it's not receiving. It's the accent with which it was. You had an accent which was acceptable for you to be received by royalty. So, which of course is complete nonsense these days, because. The way the royals speak is not, and no one else on earth speaks like that, I think. You know, the way they speak in sort of slightly upper class before, you can't quite do the same, it's all really dipped and sort of they didn't move the lips very much. It's a ridiculous way to speak. But what they generally mean these days is kind of like sort of BBC English, which is very sort of accentless, and I guess it's what your kind of CNN newscasters sound like would be the American equivalent. That was what they taught you to speak, because, of course, I'm from Manchester, so I have a northern accent, a regional accent, which is what it was quite pronounced.
So what were you supposed to fix in your speech?
Oh, well, I mean, for things like, you know, in your accent, you'd say things like, I'm going upstairs to have a bath, is how I would have said it in my original accent. Whereas in actual fact, when you do receive pronunciation, then you have to say, I'm going to go upstairs to have a bath. So there's little sort of subtle variations that you you become aware of. And it's also very, Britain's quite class-ridden and very aware of class in a way that's not as prominent in America, although I think obviously class is a real issue. It's something that people are acutely aware of in Britain. So, and your accent says a lot about that. So, you can sort of, and people, whether they like it or not, do make judgments. Put it this way: if I'm on the phone complaining about something not being delivered on time, I use my poshest voice possible to intimidate the person on the other end. Whereas if I'm trying to, if there's some kind of big heavy guy who's being a bit threatening to me, I'll drop my H's and T's to sort of talk to him on his level, so he doesn't think I'm some rarefied poncy bloke.
Just one more question: do you feel like when you're working in more or less your own voice, do you feel like you're almost working with your hands tied behind your back because you have this incredible gift for voices, and you're just using your regular old voice in it?
Yes and no. Sometimes it's easier because it's more relaxing. It's like if it's like acting in your own clothes. If you wear your own clothes, you wear the clothes you're comfortable in. If you put on a, if I put on, as I have done for when I played a woman on stage once, if you put on things that are uncomfortable or you've got to dress up in things that are strange, then it's easier to be different. But it's just, and it's easier to look more interesting. You know, if I put a hat on and lipstick and wear a corset and high heels, I'm certainly going to look slightly more interesting, if not particularly pleasant, than I look right now. And the same thing goes with your voice. If you put a voice on, it's kind of easier to get people's attention, but it's not so comfortable. You know, I spent so many years, you know, putting on silly voices and wearing wigs and moustaches and beards and things that irritate your face, that getting a chance to wear my own clothes and speak in my own voice was like a kind of holiday.
Steve Coogan, a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed.
Steve Coogan is starring in the new movie Tristram Shandy, A Cock and Bull Story. It will open gradually in theaters around the country starting at the end of the month.